pull up a chair. There's a wooden crate of a biplane I want to tell you about, and the two men who climbed into it on a soggy hillside in Newfoundland 107 years ago today, betting their lives that they could cross an ocean nobody had ever crossed in a single hop. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. Today we go back to June 14, 1919. Now most folks, if they know one name from the early Atlantic crossings, they know Lindbergh. And Lindbergh earned every bit of that fame, don't get me wrong. But Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic in 1927, 8 full years before that, two Englishmen had already done the harder version of the trick. Non-stop, coast to coast, and almost nobody remembers their names. So let's fix that today before we climb into the cockpit. Let me tell you who's keeping the lights on here at the hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, your first solo, your private, your instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of those coins tells a story, the same way the story I'm about to tell you got told for years around a hangar stove. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. The year is 1919. The Great War has been over for just 7 months, and there's a prize sitting on the table, put up before the war by a London newspaper, the Daily Mail, £10,000, a king's ransom in those days. The terms were simple and they were brutal. Fly an aircraft across the Atlantic Ocean from anywhere in North America to anywhere in the British Isles in under 72 consecutive hours. No stopping, no landing on a ship to refuel. From the coast of the New World to the coast of the Old in one unbroken flight. Several teams came to Newfoundland that spring to try Newfoundland because it's the closest jumping off point on the North American side. The shortest stretch of open water you can pick, and even that is roughly 1900 miles of cold gray nothing. Our two men are Captain John Alcock and Lieutenant Arthur Whitten Brown. Alcock was the pilot, a Manchester man, stocky, cheerful, the kind of fellow who never seemed to lose his nerve. He'd flown bombers in the war, been shot down over Turkey, and spent time as a prisoner. By 1919, he had more hours wrestling big aircraft through bad weather than just about anybody alive. Brown was the navigator, quieter, more serious. He had a bad leg from being shot down himself, walked with a limp the rest of his life. But Brown could do something that almost nobody could do reliably yet. He could find his position over open ocean using a sextant and the sun and the stars, celestial navigation, from a freezing open cockpit, in an airplane that wouldn't hold still. That was the real magic trick of this whole flight, and we'll come back to it. Now here's where it gets interesting. The airplane, they flew a Vickers Vimy. And if you don't know the Vimy, picture a great big twin-engine biplane bomber, designed at the very tail end of the war to carry bombs all the way to Berlin. The war ended before it ever got the chance, so here was this brand new heavy bomber with nothing to do, and Vickers figured, well, an aircraft built to haul a load of bombs a long way could be stripped out and made to haul fuel a long way instead. The wingspan was nearly 68 feet. Two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, big water-cooled V12s, 360 horsepower aside, wood, wire, and fabric. An open cockpit side by side, no roof, no heater worth the name, no real windscreen to speak of. Where the bomb bay and the fuselage tanks used to be, they crammed in every gallon of fuel they could carry. Right around 865 gallons of it, sloshing all around and underneath these two men. Think about that for a second. You're sitting in an open wooden boat, in the sky, surrounded by 800 gallons of gasoline, over the North Atlantic, with no radio worth a darn, no heater, and no second chance. If an engine quit out there, you came down in the water, and the water in the North Atlantic in June will kill you in minutes. That was the office these two reported to on the morning of June 14th. The field they used was barely a field at all. A sloped, rough, rock-strewn meadow near St. John's that they'd had to clear by hand. Loaded down with all that fuel, the Vimy was right at the ragged edge of being too heavy to fly. Alcock had to use every foot of that miserable pasture, and witnesses said the airplane staggered into the air so low and so slow that it just barely cleared the trees and a fence at the far end. One bad gust and the whole adventure ends right there in a fireball on a Newfoundland hillside. But she flew. Late in the afternoon, local time, they pointed the nose east, out over the harbor, out past the last rocks, and there was nothing ahead of them but ocean and the coming night. Now, let me tell you what that crossing was actually like. Because this is the part the history books make sound a lot tedier than it was. It was, in a word, a nightmare. Almost right away, they lost the little wind-driven generator that powered their radio, so now they're deaf and dumb. No way to call for help, no way to get a position fix from a ship, nothing. Just the two of them and the noise, and the noise. Two unmuffled Rolls-Royce Eagles roaring a few feet off each shoulder for hour after hour after hour. They couldn't hear each other speak. They communicated by scribbling notes and shoving them back and forth, by hand signals, by leaning in close and shouting into an ear. The vibration worked its way into your bones, until you couldn't feel your own hands. Then the weather closed in. They flew into thick fog and heavy cloud, and they stayed in it for most of the night. Now you and I, we've got an attitude indicator, a turn coordinator, a whole panel of gyros to tell us which way is up when we can't see the horizon. They had almost none of that, just a primitive setup, and the seat of Alcock's pants. And the seat of your pants is a liar in the clouds. Every instrument pilot listening knows exactly what I mean. Without a visual horizon, your inner ear will swear up and down that you are straight and level when you are in fact rolling over into a spiral. It happened to them, somewhere over the black ocean, in the cloud. The Vimy stalled and fell off into a spin. They tumbled down through the murk, with no idea of their attitude, no idea how far the water was. Alcock did the only thing he could do. He held off, kept the controls neutral, and waited for the airplane to tell him something. And finally the gray broke open and they came screaming out the bottom of the cloud deck, and there was the ocean, filling the whole windscreen. The airplane pointed nearly straight at the waves. They were so low and so steeply banked that they could hear the roar of the sea over the engines. Alcock hauled her level just a few hundred feet, maybe less, above the Whitecaps. That's how close it was. The whole flight, the prize, both their lives, all of it, came down to a few seconds and a couple hundred feet of cold air. It got worse before it got better. They climbed back up and now they ran into the real teeth of it. Sleet, snow, freezing rain at altitude. Ice started building on the airframe. And here's the detail that gets me every single time I tell this story. The engines had little gauges and air intakes out on the structure, and they were icing up and threatening to choke the engines and read false. And Arthur Brown, with his bad leg, climbed up out of his seat, out of the cockpit, into the slipstream, in the dark, over the Atlantic, in freezing spray, with the wind trying to peel him off the airplane. He climbed out onto the structure between the engines and chipped the ice away with his bare hands and a knife. More than once that night, some tellings say half a dozen times. You want to talk about a navigator earning his keep? The man kept getting out of the airplane to save it. And in between all that, Brown still had a job to do. He still had to figure out where in God's name they actually were. Every time the clouds parted for even a moment, he'd shoot the sun, or a star, with his sextant, freezing, jolting, doing the math by hand in a dim cockpit, and nudge Alcock back onto course. A few degrees of error over 1900 miles, and you miss Ireland entirely, and fly on out to die somewhere over open water when the fuel runs dry. Brown didn't miss. Now here's where it gets interesting one more time. After a whole night of this, the gray dawn finally came up behind them, and there, ahead, low on the horizon, was something that was not water, it was land. It was the coast of Ireland. They'd done it. They'd actually crossed the ocean. They came in over the little town of Clifton in County Galway, on the far west coast, and Alcock spotted what looked like a beautiful flat green field, a perfect place to set down this exhausted airplane and become famous men. Except it wasn't a field. It was a bog, a peat bog. Soft, wet, soggy ground that just looked solid from the air. The wheels touched, rolled a few feet, and dug into the muck. The Vimy pitched up onto her nose and stuck there, tail in the air, nose buried in the Irish mud after 1900 miles and change without a stop. 16 hours, give or take, from Newfoundland to Ireland. Both men were unhurt, just bruised, and Alcock, the story goes, climbed out of the wreck, and the first thing anybody could understand him saying was something to the effect of, "Well, what do you think of that for a flight?" The locals who ran out to the bog could hardly believe these two soaked, frozen, deafened men had just come from America. They had won the £10,000. They were knighted by the king within days. Sir John Alcock and Sir Arthur Whitton Brown. And for a brief shining moment, they were the most famous aviators in the world. And here's the part that just breaks your heart. John Alcock, the cheerful pilot who never lost his nerve. The man who'd been shot down, captured, and then flew an ocean nobody had ever flown. Was dead within 6 months. He was killed that December, ferrying a new airplane to an air show in France when he went down in fog near the French coast. He was 27 years old. 27 he crossed the entire Atlantic, and the weather got him on a routine hop a few months later. The fog that nearly killed him over the ocean finally caught up with him over land. Brown lived a long life, but he never really flew much again after that. The war and that flight had taken their toll, and losing his friend Alcock took the rest. He lived out his years quietly. The two of them are bound together forever, those two names, for one impossible night in June. So why does this matter? Why am I sitting here 107 years later telling you about two men in a wooden bomber, because everything we take for granted started with somebody going first in the dark with worse equipment than you'd ever accept. You file an oceanic crossing today and you've got satellite navigation accurate to a few feet, two reliable turbine engines, a pressurized cabin, data link to talk to the ground, weather radar painting the storms before you reach them. Alcock and Brown had a wet compass, a sextant, a man climbing out on the wing with a pocket knife and raw nerve. Every time one of those big airliners slides across the North Atlantic tonight, full of people sleeping and watching movies and complaining about the legroom, it's flying a path that two cold, deaf, half-frozen Englishmen proved was survivable in a stripped-out war surplus bomber. They didn't have a map of the way, they were the map. And that Vimy, by the way, the actual airplane they flew, survived. They dug her out of that Irish bog, and you can go see her today, hanging in the Science Museum in London. Go stand under her sometime if you ever get the chance. Look at how thin the wire is. Look at how open that cockpit is, and then think about what it took to ride that thing across an ocean at night. My thanks today to the Royal Air Force Museum and the Science Museum in London for keeping this story and that airplane alive. And to the old accounts, the two men left behind of that long night. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com, and the next time somebody tells you Lindbergh was first, you smile, and you tell them about a bog in County Galway, and two fellows named Alcock and Brown. This is Taildragger. Keep the blue side up, and don't ever forget the ones who went first.